Committee to order for May 11, 2007. Welcome, members. Welcome, folks, here to testify on the bills we have before us today. I'm going to start off by calling a public hearing on Senate Bill 334A. And Mr. Olson, if you'd be so kind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 334A. Replaces the Oregon Opportunity Grants with the Oregon Shared Responsibility Opportunity Grants administered by the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, changes the method of determining cost of education, excludes the Oregon Health and Science University from average cost of education calculation, authorizes the commission to determine student, family, federal, and state share of the cost of education, specifies that loans are not considered in determining student share for community college students, deletes intent language to empower and reward students who have earned a certificate of initial mastery, applies to qualified students who attend eligible institutions for the first time on or after July 1st, 2008, or who did not continuously attend an eligible institution before the 2008-2009 academic year, or who attend an eligible institution on or after July 1st, 2011. Allows eligible students currently attending an eligible institution to receive a grant amount under the current law or under this act, whichever is greater. That's the bill. There are two proposed amendments to Senate Bill 334. The A2 amendment would leave the name as the Oregon Opportunity Grant instead of changing it to the Oregon Shared Responsibility Opportunity Grant. The A3 amendment would not affect the Shared Responsibility Opportunity Grant, but would add to the bill the text of House Bill 3010, which is the subject of a public hearing by the Subcommittee on Education Innovation on April 5th, and would create the Freedom to Choose My School program, directing the Department of Education to select a large school district to administer the grant program, allow eligible students to attend public or private school under the program, direct the school district to pay grant funds to schools participating in the program, specify the amount of grant, add weighting to the state school fund formula for students who participate in the program and first applied to the 2008-2009 school year. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 334 has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members and folks here to testify, given the late start of the committee today, I would like to ask if questions can be concise, answers concise. If folks have written testimony, I'd appreciate if you didn't read your written testimony. You could submit your written testimony to the committee, and each committee member will receive it. If you can summarize written testimony, that would be greatly appreciated. With that, Mr. Olson, could you please let me know who will be first up to speak on this bill?
Yes, we have Margulow from the Governor's Office and Dennis Johnson from the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. I believe Senator Schrader is on his way also to testify on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Welcome. It's good to see you both.
Good afternoon, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margie Law. I'm with the Office of the Governor. And I'm here today to speak with the Reader's Digest version of the materials that we talked about earlier on the shared responsibility model. Several of the members of the committee got to hear more of the presentation when we were in Ashland at Southern Oregon University. And so I've captured just the most critical points and added a couple of other pieces having to do with some of the more recent questions that we've been getting about this program. Right now, the Shared Responsibility, the Oregon Opportunity Grant offers opportunity to a limited number of students. During the 2005 legislative session, we expanded the grant program to cover all eligible students. In the past, there have been cutoff dates where we were not able to offer the grants to all eligibles. But even at that, the grant was a flat grant, and the percentage of the cost of attendance that was covered with the grant was so modest that most students who most needed the grant still couldn't go to school because the amount of resources it provided were just too small. So because of that, we moved towards this new model where it's more of a need-based model where the more a student needs in order to be able to go to school, the more they're going to receive. The program, if you want to turn to this page in the handout with the graph, this illustrates the current situation in terms of how the Oregon Opportunity Grant operates in conjunction with the other programs. that provide financial aid to students who are looking for post-secondary education. The most commonly used grant is the federal Pell Grant. Until this year, that grant had been unchanged for 3 years. And it's just recently gone up, but it's unpredictable in terms of when it's modified and how much it will go up. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, as I said, was a flat grant. If you were $1 over the eligibility, you received nothing. If you're $1 under the eligibility limits, you received the same grant as a student who had no resources at all. So that being a flat grant created some problems. And then families were expected to contribute, and that was based on the federal expected family contribution calculation that's done in the federal financial aid application process. But that left a large gap for a lot of families, and that was what was causing, and is still today causing, a lot of students to either not go to school or to only go to school part-time or to step out and step back in and take much longer in which to complete their degrees. So that's much of the genesis of the shared responsibility model that we're proposing. If you turn next to the page that's got the stair steps up to the column, this speaks to the four different components of the shared responsibility model. The first one is related to the student share, and it's related to what the expectations are for students. It is generally that the student will provide half of their cost of attendance to go to school. That number is based on a reasonable number of hours of work that a student would need to do and a reasonable amount of borrowing for students who are going on to four-year degrees. So if they're going to one of our Oregon universities or one of the independent colleges in the state, borrowing is a component of that. But we hope that students who are going to our community colleges would not need to borrow. The family share is, again, calculated as a part of that expected family contribution through the federal financial aid formula. We still expect students to take full advantage of any federal programs that they're eligible for, including the Pell program, and also any tax credits. And then the state share is what would fill the gap, as shown on the chart. The next page actually shows how the student share is to be what its components would be. We've had some questions from students saying, well, do I have to show I've got my match before I can get the grant? And no, it's not that way. And if you could actually achieve part of your share through being even more economical in the lifestyle choices, that's great. But we do offer a wide opportunity for students on how they do this. If students have won scholarships through merit or other competitions, those all count towards their share. It does not offset the state share. We didn't want to inhibit private philanthropy or to inhibit student initiative. The reasonable work hours are built under the assumption that students will be able to work the equivalent of 40 hours a week during 10 weeks of the summer at our Oregon minimum wage, and also be able to work 10 to 15 hours a week during the school year. Research actually shows if a student works while they're going to school, they become better at time management and actually enhance their grade performance. The loan amount, you've heard oftentimes, I'm sure, from students during this session that Oregon students are carrying almost $20,000 of debt when they finish a four-year degree, oftentimes taking longer than 4 years to finish that degree. We're building this model around the assumption that students would borrow no more than $2,750 a year, leaving them with still the ability to a reasonable amount of debt that allows them to be social workers or teachers and be able to earn enough to be able to pay off their loans. One of the things that we've heard a fair amount of discussion about in recent days in the Capitol building is concern about what the program is going to cost. The governor's budget includes $110 million in total this next biennium for the Oregon Opportunity Grants. The first year under the existing Opportunity Grant program and the second year under the shared responsibility model. And one of the things I've learned from my many decades of public budgeting is that whenever you change something, you introduce a certain amount of uncertainty. Even when you don't change things, there's always uncertainty. So you do the best you can with the information that's available to develop a reasonable cost for that, and then you build in mechanisms on how you would manage the rest of the uncertainty, because unfortunately none of us can predict the future. So what this next page lays out are some of the variables that are built into the model that was developed by the Western Interstate Compact on Higher Education, that we call WICHE. And that's predicated on the number of recipients, the income and resources of those recipients, the schools that those students decide to attend, and the other funding sources that are a part of this, both the federal Pell formula and also the lottery funds, which also fund a portion of the shared responsibility. All of those we've had to make reasonable, cautious assumptions about, but one thing I know in doing projections is that I'm always going to be wrong. I just accept that. And sometimes I'm wrong by overestimating, and that's some of the problem we have in the current biennium with the Opportunity Grant Program. And that's for a program that we've run for several decades. And sometimes, unfortunately, we're too optimistic and we end up with not enough resources. And so I always like to build a contingency plan for how to deal with that. So if you want to turn to the next page, in our current program, the way in which we manage that uncertainty in the past has been with cutoff dates. In the current biennium, we've moved away from cutoff dates, and it was really an unfair process because we told students to file their FAFSA forms as early as possible, but we never told them how early was going to be early enough because we didn't know, because, of course, if every student filed their FAFSA by the end of January, we would have been out of money by the middle of January. And so our cutoff dates are always posted retroactively because we said, okay, at this point, that was the last student we could let in the gate. And so the very unfair process that we had to operate in the past. In the current biennium, we do it more by the metrics of the grant award size. And it's because of that that we're at the very low 11% of the cost of attendance, which, if you think about it as a parent, you're trying to send your student to college. If you only came up with the money for 11% of sending them to school, and that was all you had, they wouldn't go very far. And unfortunately, that was a problem that we posed for many students, is it just wasn't enough, and they couldn't really make the rest of the math work. So in the model, there's a component that is a very progressive way in which to structure grant awards, and that's based on the family's expected family contribution. So students who had little or no resources, they would receive the full grant award if we needed to make some adjustments. But families that have more resources, they would end up with a larger share of the adjustment going towards what their expectation would be. And that way the median students would still be protected because they really don't have other resources to fall back on, and students who had more resources would end up with a larger share of the reduction, but that's because they have more alternatives in which to explore. The bill itself contains several provisions in Senate Bill 334 that speak to how the process will be managed. You know, the bill contains broad guidelines in terms of how the program is to operate, much as what I've just shared with you and the members of the committee. The amount that the Student Assistance Commission will be able to spend is tied to the legislatively approved budget. This is not an entitlement program, and the bill specifically, you know, it's tied to the resources, and the bill's clear on that. OSAC will need to write administrative rules on how the program will operate, and if they need to structure those rules in such a way that's different than that that's at the close of session, then they're required to come back and report that to either the emergency board or the legislature prior to implementation. So we think those safeguards are important for the commission and also for you as legislators and for students in Oregon. And I just want to close, and I'd be glad to answer any questions, with the fact that, as you're aware, this program has been endorsed by many organizations who are concerned about post-secondary education in Oregon, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Knight. We'll hold off on questions, and we'll, if it's all right with you, Mr. Johnson, we'll ask Senator Schrader to go ahead and offer his thoughts on the proposal. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you. Appreciate that opportunity to talk to the committee. I'm Senator Kurt Schrader, Senate District 20. And I just would like to add my comments and endorsements to this, I think, landmark piece of legislation you have before you. There's an opportunity for Oregon to skyrocket from an F in affordability to an A almost overnight. It requires a significant investment of resources. The fiscal is indeterminate, but not indeterminate because there aren't any. It's because, as was spoken to here just a moment ago, indeterminate large. We're asking this legislature to step up and make college access affordable to every single Oregonian, as long as they're willing to work just a little bit. And that's a tremendous win-win, I think, for this state. It tells the people of this state that their tax dollars are going to be leveraged by those that really care about getting an education. You have to work a little bit to earn this opportunity. But if you work a little bit, then the state of Oregon is going to invest in you. And I can't think of a more powerful message for this body to transmit to the people of this state. I mean, this is huge. We'll be the only second state in the nation offering this sort of opportunity. While it's not an entitlement, I would hope that, Lord willing and resources willing, we'll come as close as we can to fully funding this model, starting with the second year of this coming biennium and then for a full biennium, the session after this. It'll take some leadership. It'll take some willpower. I think the an amendment's in order, certainly, to make sure that should resources diminish or demand exceed what we expect, that we can adjust things in a progressive manner. I support that. I would frankly suggest the bill move to ways and means so that our own fiscal folks can work with the governor's office and others to make sure it gets a real good look at. I think there's already some concern that the original $47 million additional money is probably an underestimate based on some of the earlier methodologies that were employed. So we want to really have a good handle on what we're offering, what it costs us, and what we're actually going to be buying in the future. I think that this is something that, from my standpoint, it's a big issue, big priority for the governor's office. It's a big priority for the Senate. I hope it's a big priority for the House. And I would look forward to your earnest consideration. And if you have any questions, I'll urge you to contact not just the governor's office, but my office also, and my assistants and the Office of the Legislative Fiscal Office's assistance in any way, shape, or form.
And you say, what time running on? Do you have a few minutes to stay and answer some questions?
Yes, sir.
And would you have Mr. Johnson?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. I just want to make three observations, or submit three areas for comment. First of all, back at OSAC, we are currently building the capacity to administer this program. We've been hard at work for the last couple of months programming. It is more complex. It is very doable. But we recognize that accurate or more accurate projections are going to be essential. So we want to be very, very careful at this stage.
Mr. Johnson, would you please introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Dennis Johnson, Executive Director of the Student Assistance Commission.
Thank you very much.
Then, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The second point I want to make is that several essential areas of the program will not change. Students will apply through the same mechanism, filling out the free application for federal student assistance, the FAFSA form. No change in that. We get electronic transmission of those application results and can make award determination. So that can start in January of each year for awards that would begin the following September. We're looking then to have a system ready for January of 2008. First awards then to be dispersed in September of 08. Now that means we really couldn't wait until summer or next fall to begin this work, and that's why we're at it right now. The disbursement system, the way we convey funds to students and to campuses, colleges and universities, we work with all of them throughout the state, that will not change. All of the electronic disbursement systems, the internet-based award postings, all of those things will not change. What will change, the areas of change now, are the way we determine award eligibility, That's what Ms. Lau was describing with the shared responsibility model. And then we also plan to do a much better job of informing students. When a student submits a free application for federal student aid or a FAFSA form, in most cases we capture an email address with which we've been doing next to nothing. Colleges and universities, of course, communicate with their applicants, but we have not. We communicate more with the campus to tell the campus financial aid personnel how much the award would be for which students. In this case, we'd like to be able to tell students shortly after they apply what they're eligible for. We'd like to change their behavior. We'd like to have more of them thinking that college is a possibility, and we'd like that to happen in the spring, perhaps, of the senior year. Certainly in the spring of the year, for decisions to be made the following, or regarding the following academic year. So a new communication system, being able to send out thousands of emails to really broadcast that good news. We're working on that. We're building the infrastructure for that right now, too. There's no reason. We can't be ready for this, ready to begin announcing awards in January and February of 2008 to really make a difference in student behavior for the academic year 2008-2009, the second year of the biennium.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Dole.
Yes. The first question is from the governor's office. When we were in Ashland, I wrote down a figure, $110 million for this program. Is that what the governor had put in his budget for this program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallin, the $110 million is the total for the biennium for 1 year of the current Opportunity Grant program, as Mr. Johnson ramps up, because right now those awards are being made for the coming academic year. We didn't want to presume the actions of any committees in the legislature. And the second year of the biennium under the new shared responsibility model of grant awarding. So the costs that we're projecting are about $74 million. And as Senator Schrader noted, there have been some changes that have occurred to the model as we've gotten better information in the month of March that have caused us to adjust what the overall cost would be if we were fully funded. But as I mentioned, the model does have mechanisms in it that we can basically change our eligibility criteria slightly in order to rebalance and stay within the amount. So we would stay within the $110 million using our projected $74 million to operate shared responsibility in year two.
Okay. Well, Senator Schrader, did I hear correctly that in the co-chair's budget, it's funded at $47 million?
Additional, yes, sir.
And but you left the door open. That there are ways that we can elevate this funding at least to the 74.
Well, that is up to this body. This is up to this body. And another 2 months from now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallin, in order to clarify, the co-chair's budget funds the program at the full $110 million that was in the governor's recommended budget. It's not been reduced. What the 47 represents is the difference in the cost between year two and the existing program and the shared responsibility model.
Those were 140 in each camp or each biennium.
Correct.
So I'm going to rest assured the $47 million is going to do it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dallin, we will manage within the $47 million in the co-chair's budget, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. Senator Schrader, you mentioned that there's one other state that does this. What state is that?
Minnesota.
Thank you. And then on my second question is more of a technical one. On page two, about a third of the way down, two-thirds of the way down, it starts talking about the type of institution that a student can go to. And it talks about a community college and a four-year institution, and it talks about a two-year Oregon-based generally accredited not-for-profit institution of higher ed. Shall be the same as in a community college. And then it goes on to OHSU. It has nothing in there that I could find, unless I missed it, about Oregon-based not-for-profit higher education institutions. So schools like Willamette, Lewis and Clark, Linfield, Pacific University, so on and so forth, are basically left out of this. Is that on purpose, or is that something that we need to fix?
It's a misread, if I may suggest that, sir. But,
Mr. Chair, if you look carefully on lines 35 through 38, that does include the not-for-profit institutions of higher education in the state of Oregon. It also adds to that OHS.
I missed it.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative, it basically includes all the schools that are currently eligible for the opportunity grant. So no one's left out there currently.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, I just missed it. Thank you.
Well, I just want to thank Senator Schrader before he gets out of here. I first came to this issue in 2000 when I was appointed to the Student Assistance Commission. He was up here and I was down there, and he was asking about the effectiveness of the grant. I mean, he's a tough nut to crack sometimes.
I'm a teddy bear, sir.
Yeah.
And we went through a process. We went through a process to sort of talk about the existing Oregon Opportunity Grant, and I think he became convinced that it is a good investment, but that it's underfunded, that it needed to be a more rational use of resources, so people who already had federal resources more than really we needed to contribute, and then there are people who don't get resources because they're too far up the income scale. And some of us on the other side were scared about change, and you know, I certainly was resistant at first to, wow, a whole different model from across the country, but it really is a fine product. And when I went door-to-door to campaign and people would ask me about how is my kid going to go to college, I was able to talk to them that this is what we're going to try and do. And I was a product of the Oregon Mead Grant myself. And in most cities around Oregon, poor kids don't have a lot of hope. Manufacturing jobs going overseas. Timber jobs gone for a while now. And this is their opportunity. And this is really a major, major expansion of this program for our state. And it does it in a very smart way. It doesn't just throw money without looking at how the money's allocated to really target need. So I just want to thank you. And I think it's excellent work. Obviously, it's a product of a lot of work, but it needed a champion.
Appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative. Vice Chair Connell.
Just one question for Senator Schrader. Senator, I noticed on the staff measure summary that your bill, as presented, originally passed the Senate 30-0. Is that correct?
Frankly, I don't know, Madam Vice Chair, but it's a pretty good bill.
Okay. And what I'm leading to, follow-up, sir? Thank you, Chair Buckley. We are being presented with two possible amendments today. Have you seen those and have any recommendations?
I have not. I prefer the bill to be fair. Well, I'm working with the governor's office.
Right.
It would be presumptuous for me to say this is Kurt Schrader's bill. A lot of people have spent some time, the privilege of working with Mr. Nesbitt and the governor's office extensively in the interim, as did several other senators and several representatives. So that being said, I'm a little leery. I haven't seen it. The name, changing the name, I don't have a huge concern about that. That's been entertained. I hope that'd be a collaborative decision at the end of the day. I prefer the intent of the bill to stay with the intent of the bill and not have some other random but worthwhile addition to the bill, if I may say so. That's
all
I know at this point.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Thank you so much for your time, Tess.
Thank you
for
all your work. Members of the committee.
Ms. Rules, please call a few more people up.
Yes, Ryan Mann and Stephanie Dunn, please.
Thank you, Tony.
Welcome. Good afternoon. I'm Chair Buckley, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity this afternoon to talk with you. My name is Ryan Mann. I'm a student at Oregon State University. And I'm also a member of OSA, the Oregon Student Association. OSA represents over 100,000 students around the state in Oregon's colleges and universities. Today I'm here to ask for your support on Senate Bill 334. Now, without repeating too much of what's been said, you know, of the details of what shared responsibility is, or reading right off of my testimony, I just wanted to touch on a few key points that I think are important. We're very grateful that last session the legislature made a historic movement in the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which is our state's only need-based aid program. This investment guaranteed all students that qualified for the grant received assistance. However, it became clear that the Oregon Opportunity Grant no longer is able to meet its goal of closing the affordability gap. It covers...
Please, I appreciate if you could summarize your testimony. We do have a written testimony, and I am very pressed for time with the committee.
Okay, sure. Most importantly, I wanted to touch on the cutoff, which has already been talked about. A lot of us, and I kind of fall in this, where I don't qualify for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, but my parents can't pay for all of my school, and I can't work all the time, so I'm kind of in that in-between area that I think is important to at least those students are not left out. So I think this is a really important program because it makes more of a staggered approach so that someone like me, who I don't need a ton of money but a little bit to alleviate some of my debt, it would be really nice. So on a personal level, I see that as a positive aspect. One more thing, I think we know that in this day and age, students can't work their way through, and we've talked about that, how it's just not possible fiscally. So I think it's awesome that this would give the opportunity for students to work, but also get some help to get through school. And then there's one stat for you. Probably hear too many stats, but our state graduated a record number of high school students last year. However, our university saw a 1.2% decrease in enrollment at our universities, which is a shame because it's more important than ever to have a degree. And we also actually saw a decrease in applications for financial aid, which means a lot of the lowest income students are not even applying anymore because it's so outrageous to afford. Initial figures have shown that the expanding grant could increase enrollment by 2,000 to 3,000 students right away. So that's pretty much what I wanted to cover. I really think it's awesome that it would be a staggered approach and that it would, most importantly, just open a college education to all Oregonians because, some people, they're not cut out for college or they don't want to go, but everyone should have the opportunity. And I think that's what this does. It really is the Oregon Opportunity. It really is the Oregon Opportunity Grant when everyone has that opportunity. So just again, asking for your support on Senate Bill 334. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Dunn?
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Dunn. I'd like to thank you for taking this time to hear from me. I'm in my fifth year at Oregon State University, and I began in 2002 as a freshman receiving the Oregon Opportunity Grant. However, in 2004, I got married, and my husband had a six-month-long internship, which kicked me off the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Mind you, it was only 6 months, so it really was not that financially helpful. During which time, when I was off the grant, I was forced to take on two jobs because I cared so much about my education and I'm willing to work. Let me tell you a little bit about how this job situation worked. We began Sunday night at 9 p.m., where I went to an elderly woman's house and I would stay the night with her, which usually meant I had to stay up until midnight, 1 a.m., taking care of her. Sometimes it was just sitting with her, reading to her, but it was work. Once I got her into bed at midnight or 1, I'd stay up for a couple more hours and do schoolwork. And then I'd be up by 8 a.m., which was sleeping in for me at that time. And then I'd have class from 9 to 11. And then I'd be at my next job as a waitress from 11:30 to 2. And then back to school from 3 to 5. And then back to waitressing from 5:30 to 8. And back to her house at 9. Being freshly married, this really wasn't all that enjoyable. But I was willing to do it because education is really important. But had I had the opportunity to have the shared responsibility model, I would not have had to work that many hours, and I would have been able to devote my time more to being a student than being a worker, because I would have put in enough time working to pay for school. During this time, I was only able to take 12 credits, which is a reason why I'm in my fifth year now, and not done four, and I'm carrying about $16,000 in debt, and I'm still looking at a little bit of time next year to make up for some of the lost time while I was working so much when I didn't do as well in school as I would have liked. My GPA suffered because I was working so hard to go through school, and someday I hope to go on to graduate school, so I do need that GPA. I know there are other students in my similar situation who are working really hard to go through school and not having enough assistance because the Oregon Opportunity Grant cuts you off, as it did me. Anyway, so I would just like to urge you to support Senate Bill 334 for students like myself and other students of different situations that are having a hard time paying for school. Being as right now, it's one of the most important times for us to be receiving a college education. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. Best of luck to you. Any questions from the members? Thank you so much. Best of luck. I hope you get those credits done and get that GPA up.
Thank you.
Good luck. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Appreciate it.
Mr. Olson.
Wendy Bennett. Wendy Bennett, please.
I dress up for you today.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Buckley and members of the committee, for giving me an opportunity to speak with you today. If you can't tell, I am a chef by profession. I am here today to represent the for-profit schools and asking that you consider adding us to the Oregon Opportunity Grant. My name is Wendy Bennett. I'm the Vice President of Academic Affairs for Western Culinary Institute in Portland, Oregon. As I said, I'm a chef by profession, and I actually went to a not-for-profit school in 1985. I invested $25,000 in my education, receiving an associate's degree in culinary arts. The current tuition at Western Culinary Institute is $38,000. I have to say that not only am I very proud of the school, the facilities that we offer, but the education that we're providing to now being in our 25th year, thousands of soon-to-be food service workers. As a representative of for-profit schools, I would just like to inform you that according to the Accrediting Commission for Career Schools and Colleges of Technology, students from for-profit colleges graduate at almost twice the rate of traditional schools, not-for-profit schools. And the statistic is 55% graduate from for-profit schools and a mere 24.7% from not-for-profit schools. This grant is designed to help the poorest of Oregonians. And I can tell you from my experience that I currently have 850 students in my school, that several of them, I won't say many, are homeless and want to change their life. Some of them have had felonies in their career and want to change their life. And quite often, as I meet with them, to say that they don't qualify for their second academic year of funding, that men who have spent years in prison look at me and cry because this was their one chance to change their life. I would ask that, being at a for-profit college, certainly I've seen the negative press associated with for-profit schools. I can tell you from experience that we are not the evil one. We provide a dynamic education in a fabulous facility. We invested over $5 million in the Galleria building in the city of Portland to refurbish that building, and we occupy a portion of the first floor and the entire fourth and fifth floor, providing convenient transportation, utilizing the MAX for our students to get to school. Currently, there are only 13 for-profit schools in the state of Oregon. I would ask that you consider offering us a portion of this grant money in order to help, again, the poorest of Oregonians, who a lot of times choose career schools rather than traditional schools in order to live, have a career that they love and get it in a short amount of time. Currently, my school offers three associate's degrees and two diplomas. And our longest program is 60 weeks, which is roughly over 14 months. It allows us the opportunity to get our students a quality education and get them onto a career that they love. I will say that the majority of our students attain success with an actual graduation rate higher than that of the national statistic, and the reason is that we care about every single student that comes to our school and want them to have a career that they love. So I would ask that you give us an opportunity to show what we can do with a small portion of the money that you have available through this grant. And with 13 schools, I'm not going to name a number for you, but even a small portion, $5,000, for us to prove to you that we can utilize this money and provide for the future of Oregon.
I'm going to need to ask you to stop there and see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Chair.
Committee.
Were you eligible for, in the past, and this is a new direction for you to not be eligible for this money?
For Chairman Buckley and Representative Dowling, for-profit schools have never been a portion of this opportunity grant.
Any other questions? Representative?
Yes, thank you very much for the testimony.
Thank you.
So how many that the institution for profit, how many are there, did you mention?
Chairman Beckley and Representative Lynn, there are approximately 13 for-profit schools in Oregon.
So how many total students?
How many total students? That's a very good question. In my school, as I said, I have 850 students. I would imagine that many of the programs are similar in size, but I don't know the actual statistic.
About 7,000. About 7,000 students.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Buckley.
Mr. Chair, Esther Hinson and Matt Wingard.
Mr. Chair, leaving the room is the best economic development investment we could ever make. Thank you, Mr. Sankla. Mr. Representative of them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Matt Wingard. I'm director of the School Choice Project for Cascade Policy Institute. We are here to testify in support of the Dash 3 amendments, which essentially amends House Bill 3010 into this bill. I just want to make a brief couple of points, and then Esther has a story she'd like to tell. We had a hearing on this bill on April 5th, which we're very grateful for. I have to tell you that it was probably one of the proudest days of my life, professional life, to bring a delegation of folks from North Portland down to testify. All of them had never been in the building before. They had never testified. And the look in their eyes when we rode the bus back and the sense of pride that they had at testifying about something that they were so passionate about and that they feel is desperately needed. Just to give you a little bit of history on this, I've become emotional because I've become involved in these people's lives. We started this program 2 years ago to reach out to the neighborhood and ask people if we could work with them to expand their options for K-12 in neighborhoods where there were chronically high dropout rates and failure to read and do math at grade level rates, and that had been going on for a long time. We didn't even fully understand the problem until we commissioned a research report, which we put out last year, and I've given you all a copy of it, that has been widely read in the community. Really, the reform efforts had been going on for 30 years, and the results have really not changed in the community over that time. And there is a tremendous sense of frustration and disenfranchisement. It is very difficult to motivate people to get involved in this effort because they just, so much time has gone by and there have been so many previous efforts to do something that haven't gone anywhere that people are really exhausted and they have given up. But the 18 months of work culminated in this bill to create a very modest pilot program for 1,000 scholarships that would be means tested for low-income kids who would also have to be in low-income neighborhoods in Portland to access the per-student money from the state and go to any school that their parent felt would be a good match for them and would deliver the education that they wanted. This bill that we're amending into the topic was about the fact that poor kids needed access to higher education. I would make the point that, they need a quality K through 12 education that they've been successful in, and a degree that really means that they are reading at, grade level in order to access that college. Whether they can pay for it is obviously an important issue too, but they need to be able to succeed at the college they're going to go to, and that requires getting a diploma that truly means that they're ready to go on to college. Since we put out this report a year ago, the community has lost the principal for the most troubled high school that they had. He went on leave and hadn't even lasted a year. The superintendent has also announced that she's leaving the district, and she wasn't quite there 3 years. And just in the last week, there's been a nationally publicized incident that occurred in this most troubled high school, and it ended up on a video web sharing site and unfortunately received a lot of national attention. I asked the researcher this report, over the last 30 years, how many students do you think have gone through the system in these neighborhoods and either dropped out or been given a diploma that didn't mean what it should have meant? In other words, they all weren't reading at 12th grade level, and they weren't doing math at a 12th grade level. And his estimation was that somewhere between 7,000 and 8,000 people went through the system. And they, as I said in the last hearing, these people don't disappear. They're there, and they show up for social services, and they're locked out of so many opportunities when that happens. We really can't wait. These neighborhoods can't wait for two more years to have another shot at coming down. I understand the process, and it's not necessarily as clear to them that they'll have to wait 2 years in order to bring this pilot project back again. Poor parents really need this choice, and I'll let Esther take over.
Chairman Beckley and committee, thank you for the opportunity to come before you again. As a teacher as well as a parent, I can speak to the fact that this bill is so needed. As a parent, I had a daughter in high school, in middle school at the time. After my divorce, I had her in private school. She was doing really well, but after divorce, I had to take her out because I couldn't afford to keep her there, and I put her into public school, and the result was not the same, and I was very unsatisfied with what had happened. So I really know that if I'd had a chance, an opportunity to have a voucher, some kind of assistance to keep her in a private school, her schooling would have been much better, and she would have had the attention that she needed, that I as a parent knew that she needed. And also, I speak for parents, single parents who are raising children. And not only that, we have parents and grandparents who need the help as well, because a lot of them are not educated where they can help the children. And the public school system is not giving the time to help these parents and grandparents. And so they need to have the opportunity to put their grandchildren into some kind of private school where they can get that extra help that's needed. As an instructor, as a teacher, I work with GED students, and I see the changes. I see the need for special attention or a private type setting of schooling for a lot of students, many students who come through my class and need help. So I don't want to take a lot of time, but I just want you to understand that there is a need for private schools or a special bill like this to help parents, grandparents, or whomever, relatives, to get their children well educated, just not thrown into a system or into a school because they live near it, and they need to be in a school where they can be served properly. Thank you.
Just one last point. Would you please just state your name for the record?
I'm sorry. Esther Henson.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
I just wanted to say that it took weeks of effort to organize the folks to come down for the hearing that happened on April 5th. It wasn't possible for me to organize it because people have jobs or they're in school. Yes. So they are on this letter, listed on this letter that I handed to you.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Any questions?
Representative Greenup.
Yes, I Yes, I'm
the only one representing the Portland School District. And my understanding from reading it, this is directed at the Portland School District. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green Lake, yes, the pilot program would take place in certain neighborhoods in the Portland Public School District.
And what are those neighborhoods?
Unfortunately, I don't have that sheet in front of me. A lot of you do in your bill packets, but there are about a dozen schools. I know the Roosevelt and Jefferson High School areas for the high school kids, and then there are two or three middle schools. I'm not going to be able to remember this off the top of my head. I don't think I have that. And then there's about eight or nine elementary schools. Well, there was a, I did do a one page, I'm sorry that I don't have it, but it went out and I believe it was in most people's.
Members, just to clarify, we did hear this bill proposed, I believe it's in front of the Subcommittee on Education and Innovation early in April on a different bill number. So I think that's what the.
3010, you were saying.
Most of these green schools are in the Northeast Portland area, just east of
Olson has the list here.
Okay.
Mr. Olson? Excuse me, Mr. Wingard, I just found the list in my bill packet. And some of the materials that Mr. Wingard handed out, we're going to make copies and hand out to the community. We didn't have sufficient at present. It says, tentatively, the school neighborhoods that would qualify were the Boise, Elliott, Clarendon, Humboldt, King, Lent, Peninsula, Wrigler, Rosa Park, Sitton, Vernon, Whitman, Woodland, Woodmere, Binsmead, MS, George, Lane MS, Ockley Green MS, Portsmouth MS, Tubman MS, referring to middle schools, Jefferson High School and Roosevelt High School.
And since we declined to act on it under the old number, what makes you think what's changed since then that makes you think we're acting enough?
I leave that to the committee, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenbeck. We're here to ask that the bill move forward. Whether or not it will, obviously, it depends on this committee.
But there's nothing changed between
the bill. We haven't changed.
When we declined to act on it, it's 3010. No.
The representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, the bill is the language of the amendment is precisely the same as the bill HB 3010.
And if we don't act on it now, will you find another vehicle to come back?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, if you would like me to find another vehicle, if we fail today, then I'd be happy to work with your office to find another vehicle.
No, yes,
we would like to advance the bill.
I prefer you bury it, actually. It would very much be my preference.
Representative Donald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Being a school superintendent and sitting in Chair Cox's committee, I saw a teacher, and there's a handful in a 25-year career, that has the charisma that man had. He was phenomenal. I probably am not moved as much as you are, but after 30 years, we can try almost anything and do better.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much for bringing your idea forward.
Thank you, sir.
Members, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 334A and open up a work session on Senate Bill 334A. There are two amendments to the bill. The first one is brought to my attention by Representative Clem, so I'll recognize Representative Clem first.
Thank you. I'll move the dash two amendments.
Representative Clem has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 334A. Is there discussion? I'll speak to it briefly. Representative Clem,
the important thing about the shared responsibility model of the Oregon Opportunity Grant is that we change the way the program is run to reflect the shared responsibility. That's pretty much the guts of the bill. The one piece that two clarifies is that we're not actually changing the Oregon Opportunity Grant name to OSROG, the Oregon Shared Responsibility Opportunity Grant, because it's and you'll hear most people talk about it as the shared responsibility model of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and it's not the Oregon Shared Responsibility Opportunity Grant. And so I am not into changing names unless something's broken. In part, the model is going to be changed. The name would stay the same as it is, and all of our letterhead marketing materials and all that kind of thing. I talked to Senator Schrader, as he indicated. I talked to folks in the governor's office, and no one seemed to have a strong objection to that.
So once it gets clarified, the name will be, if this amendment passes,
Oregon Opportunity Grant.
Thanks again, and the Oregon Shared Responsibility Opportunity Grant.
Further discussion on this amendment?
Excuse me.
Vice Chair Cup?
Just clarify, Representative, I mean, how it is changing, so they'll have to change all the paper and letterhead, or it's the amendment is to make sure it doesn't change.
Correct.
Thank you. That's
Thank you.
Mostly a question for Representative Clinton. Will it still have the shared responsibility model in here? Or is it taken out completely?
All the different elements of the bill that describe the student's role, the parent's role, all of that stays in there.
Right.
The words shared responsibility get removed from the portions that describe the name of the thing.
Okay.
But the concept stays in it. And, you know, I think in the marketing materials around here, it'll always have a parenthesis that says shared responsibility model right next to it. But instead of changing the actual grant name, we just change the model of the grant, leave the grant name the way it is. It used to be the Oregon Need Grant.
Right.
There was a foot thrown, I think, by Senator Cliff Thrill, my former boss. He still wants it back to the Oregon Need Grant. I cannot help him.
But it wouldn't work as well now.
That's right.
Any further discussion on the amendment?
No, Mr. Chair, the name will be the same. No changes with your amendment.
That's correct. Oregon Opportunity Grant.
Whatever short of, I'm for it.
Thank you, Representative. Is there objection to the amendment?
Hearing none, bill so amended.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the -83 amendments into Senate Bill 334.
Representative Kremel has moved -3 amendments to Senate Bill 334. Discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
I strongly object to that. And I'm the only one that represents the Portland Dual School District, which is attacked by this amendment. I've observed the Portland School District working very hard to solve the problems. It is a difficult set of problems. My son-in-law worked at one of those middle schools listed for 12 years, working to help improve the education at that district. My daughter works in a school that I think is affected by this, has worked very hard as a special education teacher, making sure kids know how to read by the time they're in the third grade. I think the district has a huge problem dealing with its issues, and I think the school district has worked with the communities to try and create the kind of choice within the public school system that are available to kids. And I don't view this district, this amendment, as one that's very useful for helping to solve the problem. I think it's one that deflects attention in the wrong way. It provides a divisive input into the system, and I strongly urge my colleagues not to adopt the amendment.
Thank you, Representative. For the discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cromwell.
Thank you for the opportunity. I think as opposed to looking at this as the district being attacked, I think it's another tool for the people that live in the district to be able to utilize. Whether, and it's looking at a model of similar to what we're doing with the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The money follows the student. And if the student enters, it's understood that the money is, you know, if the student is going to go to a religious private school, they wouldn't be able to do that. But the way this is written allows a student, irrespective of their economic station in life, the same opportunity that, you know, those rotten rich kids get when they decide that they're going to move to whatever other school that they may want to go to. The only difference is that their parents can afford it, and these students can't. I think it's very appropriate that this kind of an amendment be put into Senate Bill 334, considering what the topic of the bill overall is, and as opposed to just having it be at the collegiate level, but also having it be at the K-12 level. I would urge my colleagues on the committee to adopt the amendment.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dahlem and Representative Robin.
So, I would like to say that I'm reminded of the last session. And the attempt was, I think, by Senator Walker and Senator Cruz to change the structure of the ESD. I was totally opposed to Senator Brunick. I felt like it was an attack on the ESDs. I barred my arms and stood in the door. And as usually happens in the building, they went around me. Really, they went around me once or twice. I don't see this as hostile. I don't see this that way at all. I'm going to look at this through the prism of a student's eyes. And with the principal, Ron, and I followed that very closely, and with Vicki Phillips leading. Before we can generate, this would be a pilot program. We got a report on the pilot program for the ESDs. And much to my chagrin, it's doing very well. And in fact, we're going to look at a bill to straighten out some things so that pilot program can continue. This is a pilot program. That's all it is. And I wish that you could have been at our community. The sense of urgency, the sense of desperation, the sense of let's try something, I think overwhelmed the room on that day. So I see this as an opportunity to perhaps break that 30-year cycle. Hostile, no more than the ESD program was hostile last year. And I perceived that as hostile last year. In fact, I made some remarks I wished I had back now.
Thank you, Representative. I'm sure none of the rest of us have experienced that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My problem with the amendment and the bill is this bill has a specific purpose. It has a specific thing with respect to higher ed, and I think that it needs to stay that way, so it'll be hard. I appreciated the testimony at the other hearing with regard to what was going on, and I hope that we can continue to encourage private investors to do some things to help that kind of thing happen. And at some point in the future, we need to look at it. But right now, the bill at hand has to do with higher ed, and I think it should stay that way. So I'll be a no on the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. I'm going to go ahead and get Representative Clemmer or something.
Just, I feel very similar to Representative Robin. The original bill is one of the most important things to me personally, not only in my life in terms of how I have been able to make a better life for myself, but to this state. And I can see already we would lose one vote for that bill on the floor. It passed the Senate 30-0, and I wasn't on the subcommittee. I've heard one side of a brief portion, it sounds like, of one side of the argument, and I do not and cannot support jeopardizing this other bill if it means members fall off. And you know, I don't know about the merits of the other part because I wasn't on the subcommittee, but this bill is too important for me personally to be able to support risking losing votes because there's two different things lumped together in one bill.
Thank you, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to say I don't believe this is friendly to the district. If it was, then any of the people that have been spending the last 20 years struggling with the problem would have been here supporting it. I represent those, what was the term? Something rich kids that can go to private schools. And in fact, what's happened in the Portland School District is the rich kids in my district continue to support the public school system. When that changes, we're going to be in big trouble. And I think having this option and highlighting it will only reduce the support of the rich kids for the school district that are now very supportive of the public schools. We're one of the few large cities in the country that has an adequate public school system, and I think the education district in the state is dependent on keeping the Portland public school system working and working well. I can guarantee you that mine will not be the only vote that drops off on the bill, that I suspect the Portland delegation will lock up against the bill. And I agree the bill itself is extraordinarily important. So to jeopardize the success of the base objective of this bill by putting what I believe is a totally extraneous amendment on it is, I mean, a terrible idea, both in terms of public policy and politically.
Thank you, Representative. I'm going to go ahead and ask Andy to do a roll call on this motion.
Representative Clem?
No.
Representative Dahlem?
Yes.
Representative Greenlick?
No.
Representative Kahn?
No.
Representative Krummel?
Yes.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
No.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Buckland?
No. The motion fails. We're going to have a work session now for the bill itself as amended, and Representative Wisner had asked Mr. Johnson to come back for if he would join us for this work session, and Representative Kopp, I'd entertain a motion to get us started.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move SB 334A with the -2 amendments to the floor with the subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means.
Representative Kopp has moved Senate Bill 334 to the floor with a due pass as recommended. As amended recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means due prior reference.
That's right.
President Wisner, you want to start us off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, this is, it's not pronounced low, it's low. American last session. I have two questions, Mr. Chair. First is, you said you've been working on implementing this and everything. How are you going to handle the student work income? Are you just going to assume it's minimum wage and 48 and take that in? You're not going to ask them to bring pay slips or anything like that in?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, the model assumes that the student will be able to bring that amount of earnings or contribution to their portion of funding or education. We will not expect any documentation to come from the student, or, and that would be very labor-intensive to even keep track of. So.
Good, I assume correctly. So you're just going to give them that assumption to start with.
Yes.
Then I guess for the other question, and I won't go into, I won't expect a lot of reply, because I'm sure the Ways and Means will look into it, but, you know, it doesn't appear to me that we're adding a lot, because we've still been only looking at the grant money and the state money, but you've asked for an annual 603.34 FTEs and $600,000 to administer the program, and I'm not sure how you're going to have to justify that in Ways and Means, so you don't have to comment if you don't want to.
Thank you, Representative. You can say it for Ways and Means if you'd like to.
Well, just briefly, I think one of the shortcomings in the existing program is lack of students' awareness. And an important part of this is going to be really to do the outreach so that Oregonians really understand the new opportunity that's there.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Further questions? No other questions of these folks? Thank you so much for your time and patience. Mr. Johnson did a great job there, let me just say. Yeah, we are under a motion. Is there further discussion on
the bill itself.
With the -2s, just briefly, one of the proudest things I'll get to do in this legislature probably is get to vote on this bill as it moves its way to the floor. I just think it's an incredible, like I mentioned, on the students walking out the door, it is one of the best economic development tools we can make. Take people that we've already invested a lot of resources of the state in to get them to college age. Take the neediest of those and make sure they can finish, and in 4 or 5 years they're right back in the economy pouring income taxes, job growth, and economic development back into the coffers versus hoping that somehow the old economy we used to have in Oregon returned. So I'm going to obviously support the bill.
Thank you, Representative.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, what's the motion?
Is the motion to move the bill to the floor with due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair,
doesn't help.
Just a quick comment. I think this is a good bill, and I'm glad to see it going. I think we could have made it better a few minutes ago. We didn't do that, and I know that there's a difference of opinion between myself and the representative from North Portland, Northwest Portland. But at any rate, it is still a good bill, and my intention is to support it.
Thank you, Representative.
Members, I'm very proud to be able to move this bill forward today. I appreciate your time and consideration of it. I'm sure many of us worked as we went through school, and this idea, I think, is just has tremendous popularity from the hearing in Ashland. I've gotten tremendous feedback from it. I think it's a great step forward for our state. And with that, Andy, would you please call the roll?
Representative Clem?
Yes.
Representative
Dolan? Aye.
Representative Greenlight?
Aye.
Representative Cobb?
Aye.
Representative
Cobb? Aye. Representative Lynn? Aye. Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Lesnar?
Aye.
Chair
Buckley?
Aye.
The motion carries. Best of luck in Ways and Means.
Yeah, this is the one bill that's not going near the
dot. Yeah, and there will be some attention paid to this bill in Ways and Means.
And I want to purposely thank all of the members here who voted with a pirate sign except for Representative Clem, who was a pirate, which I was disappointed in.
With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 334A. I'm going to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 261A.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll call Senate Bill 261A. It states that all post-secondary students with print disabilities should have equal and effective access to instructional materials in alternative formats, requires a publisher with a request from post-secondary education institution to provide instructional materials in electronic formats, provides exceptions, authorizes the State Board of Higher Education to develop guidelines to administer this act, it defines terms related to print disabilities and instructional materials in alternative formats, it declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007, and Mr. Chair, for the record, an apology. I forgot to have the agenda in large font as I was planning to do, given this bill on the agenda. So my apologies to members of the audience for that oversight.
Thank you, Mr. Rolls.
Mr. Rolls, we have folks who want to get around this bill?
Yes, perhaps we could first have a panel with Bob Junedep, Ted Wink, I believe I'm reading this correctly, and David Chittenden.
Was inquiring about whether we're going to try to get through the other three bills. We are going to try to in the next 15 minutes if we can. We'll get as far as we can. Or even 20, says the good representative.
I go 25.
So there's more representative. Gentlemen, welcome. And please, I don't mean to be rude, but we're very short on time to hear the bills that we have before us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Chindef. I'm the director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. I'm here today to introduce staff attorney from my office, Ted Wank, who will take you through the bill.
Thank you so much. Mr. Wank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Ted Wank. I'm a staff attorney with the Oregon Advocacy Center. And basically, this bill will require colleges... it'll allow students at colleges with disabilities to obtain textbooks in accessible format. And that would be students with, whether they have a physical learning or vision impairment that prevents them from accessing a regular print textbook, it'll require the textbook publishers to provide their electronic format in the instances where they have a digital format available to format that and provide it to the student via the college's disability student services office. Right now, the public colleges and do have an obligation under the ADA to provide accessible textbooks, and what essentially this involves is them going, ordering a print textbook, stripping the binding off, and then feeding it into a scanner, and then formatting it. And that requires a substantial amount of resources on part of those very limited offices and stressed financially offices. This will require, along with another about a dozen states now, that the publishers take their electronic format, and they're in a better position to do so, and format that. The bill will protect their copyright, and it requires that the student be currently enrolled in a class and need that text material for that class and as verified through the disability offices. So that's essentially what it's doing here. And we have a student right here who's directly impacted by this. And I'll let him, he has some figures and some other comments on this.
Very good. Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is David Chittenden, and I am a graduate student at Portland State University. I'm here representing Portland State University and have information from the Disability Resource Center, who scans the books. First of all, the packet that I handed you, you'll note, is three different scans. The different scans are an easy book, middle of the road book, and a very difficult book to scan. As you can tell on these scans, there are errors, and scanning rates, when you hear like 99% error free or 99% accurate or 98% accurate, that you think the words are accurate and some of the words are off, but it actually is letters or symbols. So with one symbol changed, you could have a word that makes no sense. For easy books to scan, it takes about, say 15 days to a month to scan. Well, scanning the book is quick, but proofreading the book, we use spell checkers and such that highlight errors, and then the scanning technician reads, looks at one screen that shows the actual page and another screen that shows the OCR page, the converted page, and they go through and find the major errors. Still get some errors, but it's not quite as bad as what you see there, but that takes time. It can take, with the most complicated scan, it can take up to 10, 12 minutes per page to convert the book. And just to get four students with print disabilities, for just this last winter quarter, there were 61 books that were scanned, a total of 21,061 pages were scanned. Only 8 books were received, were we able to get from publishers. And in fact, that number is more by about double of what it was just a year ago, where it was 4 books, 1, 2, 3, and 4 books that were received from publishers. So they don't want to really, you know, it's been the case where it's been difficult to get those books that would make it much easier. It can take up to 3 months when they get the book before they can convert it. And, in fact, what they do, because there's so much work, there's 10 people scanning books, but there's so many books being scanned, and it takes so long that I don't even get the entire book. They take the syllabus, look at the syllabus, and whatever chapters the instructor says, do chapters 1, 4, 5, 7, 8, I will get chapters 1, 4, 5, 7, 8. I won't get chapters 2, 3, or 6. So, and then I have to use that to study, use that to learn as best as I can what I need to know. So this is absolutely essential. It will free up, you know, because in addition to books that are scanned, we also scan handouts, class handouts, teachers' handout articles, teachers', you know, all sorts of other information in addition to the textbooks.
Good to clarify. You're just talking about Portland State University.
I'm just talking about Portland State University.
Going on at every.
This is, and where we have in our DRC, we have 800 students this quarter, or last quarter, I'm sorry. Okay. Here in the winter quarter, we had 800 students. 24 students required this particular service.
Thank you very much. We're Representative Roland.
Yes, just a quick question. I think we had a similar bill last session, and I am exceedingly happy to see it here again. Do you know how many publishers currently do not have an electronic format of any of their books before they print them? Are there any out there that don't?
No. All publishers nowadays take their books and convert them into a very proprietary system so that they can format them, proof them, and everything else, and then they convert it back into paper so that they can receive the
payment from people purchasing the books.
Oh, yes, sir, Robin. So it would be relatively easy for them to make an electronic format to send to schools with an understanding that the school would only use that for such purposes.
Right.
Okay.
Now, there would be, there's a concern of very old books, which are, you know, which were done in an older era where they didn't have computers. But that's very few and far between.
Thank you. Vice Chair Cobb.
I would just like to make a comment in support of this bill. When I started my doctoral program in 1998, one of my colleagues and soon to be one of my best friends in that program could not see font unless it was really increased. And if you can imagine, as a college student, just your regular amount of reading that you required, but as in a doctoral program, it's exponentially greater. And she was not able to work, and that's only because at that time she was copying her own. She'd purchase a textbook, and then she'd go to the copy machine. She got money for the paper to print her information on at that time, but the system that was being described here was just beginning or not in that stage. And the challenges of somebody that is so incredibly capable to pursue their work, because her doctorate was in talking about special education and people with disabilities. She was just phenomenal. But the amount of time that consumed out of her own individual life made it just an incredible barrier. But as many of us that have high barriers, we're very tenacious at times. And so this is long overdue, and thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Vice Chair Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have a question for the administrator. I thought I read in the press today something about a bill coming before us that would reduce the cost of textbook material to students generally. I mean, I strongly support this bill. Was it this bill they were talking about?
Well, that's
another one coming.
Separate bill, which may or may not come to our committee, and probably speed this if we don't get into that, just because it has some controversy on that one.
The other one, I certainly hope it does come here, because I've been watching my grandchildren and colleges spending $1,000 or more a year on textbooks, and I remember the day I refused a publisher's contract for a book I had already written because they were going to charge $40 for it, and I thought that was a totally outrageous price for a book that I didn't want any royalties on. And now they're $400 and $500 a book. I mean, so
Thank you.
Is wonderful. I have no objection to this one.
Yeah, we most likely will see it if it comes to this.
I don't pursue what other good.
No, not now.
But we will.
I'm sure we will. If there's no additional questions for these witnesses, I'll thank you very much for your time. Thank you for your patience as well in coming forward with this idea.
Ms. Rolls?
Tim Gardner and Brett Roulette, please.
Thank you very much.
So,
I was surprised that Representative Clem wasn't coming over the dais.
Is this
any
student assistance
commission? Yeah, it has a lot to do with the student assistance commission.
Mm-hmm. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. He's not listening.
I know.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for the Association of American Publishers, which represents the major, among other entities, the major textbook college textbook publishers in the United States. And I am pleased to say that we had an opportunity to work very closely with Bob Jundeff and his team in formulating the version of the bill that you see before us. We think it's a very workable bill, and we're pleased to endorse it, commend it to your attention, and urge that you pass it.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner.
No, if you mind, Jim.
It is.
Good afternoon, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brett Rillette, legislative director for the Oregon Student Association, and I will try to keep this real brief. OSA supports this bill. We think this is a wonderful bill for students. Those of you on the higher education subcommittee saw the hearing that we put together earlier this session that dealt with the reduction or the impact on student services around the state at community colleges and universities due to decreased state support. And part of the services that have been impacted are disability services on campuses. We've seen a great increase over the past two decades in the number of students with disabilities attending our post-secondary institutions. And so this is a bill that will go a long way in making sure that they have all the resources necessary to get the education that they need to help make sure that they have a bright future. So we ask you to support this. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Rowland. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, gentlemen. Those are our last two witnesses. I'd entertain a motion since we are in work session.
Chair Buckley, I move Senate Bill 2261A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Compton, Senate Bill 261A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Roebling.
Just a comment on this one. I've talked about this in the other committees with my dyslexia, but one of my interesting class experiences in advanced math at a university in this state, we had a summer school in a non-Euclidean geometry class, which I enjoyed a lot. We paid for our books because they hadn't come yet, and they were delivered actually to us the day after our final exams. We were given, since we had already paid for them, we'd been given permission for the professor to copy pages, and so we'd get pages as we needed them. And I realized as a math person, I love the textbook because the way I oftentimes learn is reading the chapter, the next chapter. You go through two or three chapters and all of a sudden the chapter before makes sense. It's not, and so when I was hearing him explain that you only get the chapters they give you, that's really a disadvantage because people who have a trouble with math think they have to learn it in that chapter and they get stuck on it. And people who like math read ahead and find out that, oh yeah, now that makes sense the chapter before. It's the same as good readers do. And I didn't realize how much of a disadvantage not having the whole book was until that summer school. We did okay. We ended up in a lot of study groups with other people because there was a lot of people in my class who didn't really particularly like math. They thought since it said non-Euclidean, it would be a lot of fun. It wasn't as much fun for them as they thought. And so,
your money back?
No, we got our book.
After the class.
But we'd already paid for it. And in fact, because of the fact that the publisher had given permission to copy the book, only on the assumption that we would buy the book, so we'd already paid. So we were okay with that. They did everything they were supposed to do right. I got through the class, but I liked the book. I'm not sure the rest of the class wanted it.
I appreciate the story. I can hear my wife's voice in my head right now.
She can't see it for 4 or 5 hours. You got a lot of drugs.
I'm due there. Representative Green, do you have anything to say? Thank you very much. Representative Donald. Would you please say with me and call the roll, please?
Representative
Clem. Aye, Mady.
Representative Gollum.
Aye.
Representative Greenlink.
Aye.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative Lim.
Aye.
Representative Roebling.
Aye.
Representative Wisna.
Aye. Excuse.
Chair Buckley.
Aye. Motion carries.
Vice Chair Clough, would you be willing to carry this?
I would love to carry it.
Thank you very much. Members, I'm going to open up one more bill. We have someone that's going to testify on Senate Bill 198. So I'm going to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 198A. Would you want to call both these folks?
Alan Contreras from the Office of Association at OSAC and Mickey Siraki, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, from Everest College.
And Mr. Olson, would you like to come up? Yes. And a quick review of the bill, if you would, please.
Yes.
And members, we might just, depending on how complex this seems, we might just take testimony. I want to make sure these folks have a chance to testify on the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 198 defines a diploma mill, excludes from definition schools that offers degrees in only theology or religious occupations, authorizes OSAC to terminate activities of diploma mills and unrecognized post-secondary accrediting bodies, adjusts the for inflation the schedule of fees, adds fee for partial degree programs, authorize the commission to assess costs for use of experts. President emergency begins July 1st. There's a
to add a sixth amendment for the committee. That is my understanding is this consensus amendment between the private colleges and OSAC that would eliminate the provision that requires the office of reauthorization to adjudicate alleged violations of the standards of regional's accreditors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Alan Contreras from the Office of Degree Authorization. Senate Bill 198 is essentially our fix-it bill for this session that deals with a variety of issues. I think most of these are fairly straightforward, although I'd be glad to answer any questions that you have. We have not had a good definition of diploma mill in statute. We would like to, and that's what this does. We have I've seen around the country a lot of situations in which people set up entities claiming to be accreditors and start accrediting schools. We would like to be able to make sure that unless the commission recognizes them, they cannot practice that particular craft for the purpose of advancing diploma mills. We are dealing with a couple of minor technical matters related to fees, and we are dealing with a situation in which we want to make sure that if a school is actively seeking regional accreditation, that we don't classify them as a diploma mill. That is consistent with law currently in use in the state of New Jersey. It has worked quite well. We worked that out with an unaccredited private college that is, in fact, seeking regional accreditation. And unless you have any further questions, I'm going to go on to the Dash 6 amendment. When this bill came out of the Senate Education Committee, we thought we were done, and Senator Walker certainly thought that we were done. She was very tired of us at that point. many changes. We subsequently came across a situation that we thought would never happen, which is that there's a provision that's been in the law since 1997, which says that if a complaint is made against a regionally accredited Oregon institution, a private institution, Northwest accredited, and the Northwest Association declines to determine whether its own rules have been violated, that the complaint can be brought to us, and we, ODA, the state agency, will determine whether the rules of the Northwest Association, a private entity, have in fact been violated by a private Oregon college. In recent discussions with the Independent Colleges Association, it's become quite clear to them, to me, and anybody else who looks at this, that it is not a tenable way of setting up a regulatory structure to have a state agency make a final binding determination of whether a private college is in fact meeting the standards of a private membership organization with which the state has no particular relationship. For that reason, we're proposing the Dash 6 amendments here to make that regulatory activity go away. I should also mention that in the 10 years that this has been in the statute, there has been no case brought to us. A case came up earlier this year that apparently has been settled out of court. Well, that's a good place for it. We don't want those in our agency, and that concludes my testimony.
Thank you so much. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be very brief. My name is Nikki Siraki. I'm president of Everest College in Portland. It used to be Western Business College. We've been there for a little over 50 years. We fully support the 198. We feel that unaccredited diploma mills in the state really undercut the legitimacy of schools that are trying to provide quality instruction to our students. We are a private, proprietary, for-profit school, but we do fully support accreditation, and we fully support the regulatory rules of the state. That's it. Thank you.
That's great.
We thought you'd like it.
Also, the Oregon Independent College Association could not be here because the director of that is out of town. There's a written statement supporting the bill with and also supporting the A6 amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Mr. Sweeney, question.
Brief question.
Yeah, can you give me the name of some of the schools that might be considered a diploma mill under this definition?
A couple. I'm just looking for some. What we would consider a diploma mill. There's an entity called Knightsbridge University that supposedly operates out of Denmark. There's a whole bunch of things in the Caribbean on the island of St. Kitts. A lot of them are outside the United States. Some of them, I had a call yesterday about one that claimed to be British, but it actually operates out of some office in Dallas, Texas. The problem today is that you can't find them. They all operate off the web. And you don't know. They claim to have an office here, there, or wherever, and they all turn out to be mailboxes.
I think that answers my question.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Seraki said that they support the bill. Do they support the A6 amendments?
Sorry, yes, we do.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. If this is a thing we need to discuss, I'd be glad to schedule it if you're comfortable.
Sure.
Vice Chair Kopp.
Mr. Chair, I'm...
We're in public hearing work session.
Okay. I move the -6 amendments into Senate Bill 198A.
Vice Chair Kopp, move the -6 amendments into Senate Bill 198A. Is there any discussion?
Nope.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, so amended. Vice Chair Kopp.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 198 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Kopp moves Senate Bill 198A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Discussion? Hearing none, would you please call the roll?
Representative
Green Light?
Aye.
Representative Green Light?
Aye.
Representative Crumble?
Aye.
Representative Crumble?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett? Aye. Representative Wisnett? Excused?
Chair Buckley?
Aye. The motion carries. Thank you, members. For a second, I just wanted to note before I raise that the Oregon system of making sure that our degrees are valid, and the rest of us who have paid for valid degrees and gone to school aren't competing with people who didn't. Ann Allen, in particular, are nationally renowned. He is routinely in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, invited to national conferences, because we really take it seriously.
Is there only she with a diploma, Bill? Or
unless you... I'm telling those two beavers that we're here now.
Mr. Chair, how about the consent calendar on this one?
Any objection to the consent calendar?
Thank you, Representative. This is the place on the consent calendar. I'm going to close public hearing work session on Senate Bill 198A and thank all members for your time and participation. Representative Crumble.
Before you adjourn, are we going to carry over 199?
Our Monday schedule is very packed. I think that Mr. Olson is going to look for the best possible place. But thank you for asking that question. So we're going to have that bill on the consent calendar. We're going to put that on the consent calendar.
It's part of the education process.
Okay. Well, okay. Mr. Chair, I know you're expected somewhere, but we need to remember that Monday's University of Oregon Day. So.
Are we supposed to wear something?
I don't know.
We questioned the global meal thing. Did the University of Oregon win any national sports?
Hey, we have a
thank you, members. Have a great weekend. See you all.
All the champions. All the champions.